y'all. Welcome to the Marty Smith's America podcast, volume 55. We have an icon, a legend in the sports broadcasting arena on the program this week, and I'm thrilled and humbled that he took the time to do it. Brent Musburger, who, like me, is the sports soundtrack of many of those of you listening, your life, and certainly your youth. I can remember sitting on the couch with my daddy as a young man, as a boy, sitting there with dad and watching the NFL Today on CBS with Musburger and Jimmy DeGreek and Irv Cross and all of those folks. And back then, there weren't all of the channels in from which to gain your sporting knowledge, whether that's news, highlights, whatnot, news stories. And back then, there was just that show. And there was no Sports Center yet, and there was no ESPN yet, and all those things. It didn't exist, and it's certainly social media. And so those guys just became, we welcomed them into our homes. They became almost family members with what they gave us from an entertainment and news perspective. And I have been, in the last couple of weeks, binge-watching sports history documentaries, 30 for 30s, and Football Life on NFL Network. I really like those a lot. I rewatched the Senna movie, which if you guys haven't seen it, please go find it. It might be the greatest movie I've ever seen. And, you know, we just a couple weeks ago on here talked about that Hurley Haywood movie with Patrick Dempsey. All those things. I've been watching them a lot. And I just don't watch live TV anymore. I don't know why. I just don't. I would rather sit down and read a book or certainly spend time with my children outside than I would to sit in front of the television. But when I am, I'm really immersing myself in history and the icons of yesteryear that really shaped my life and that kind of storytelling. And anyway, as I watch these movies, I've noticed that Brent Musburger is in damn near every one of them. Whether it was calling Lakers Celtics or sitting alongside, you know, as I stated, Irv Cross and Jimmy DeGreek and those folks on NFL Today, man, he was there for most of them. And I'll tell you, I will never forget standing on the hill above the backstretch at New Hampshire International Raceway in 2007. And I'm standing there nervous as hell. I was so nervous because I was actually on the pre-race, the NASCAR Countdown pre-race program, to report some news story or give insight into some news story that was breaking in the sport at the time. And at that time, Brent was the host of our NASCAR Countdown show. And so I'm standing on this hill with this camera in my face. My heart is beating out of my chest because Brent Musburger is about to toss it to me on live national television. And I could not believe that Brent Musburger was about to talk to me on TV. And I remember talking to my daddy after, and he could not believe that Brent Musburger actually said my name. Said it on TV. Pretty damn cool. And I just, that guy, if it was an important sporting moment since 1975, he probably called it. Other than, of course, the miracle on ice, which was Al Michaels. And we all know, we've heard that. Do you believe in miracles a trillion times in our lives? But man, Brent was the voice. He was the soundtrack of so many of those iconic moments. So to get to spend this time with him was very, very special for me. And you're going to learn a lot about his path. I certainly did. But before we get to Brent, I want to just discuss hiring with you guys. Because hiring can be really challenging. But there's one place you can go where hiring is not challenging. And in fact, it's simple, fast, easy, and smart. A place where growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. That place is ZipRecruiter.com/Marty. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there, Travis. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one of them and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective, in fact, that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in the first day. Right now, my listeners, you guys can try ZipRecruiter for free. at this exclusive web address that includes my name, ZipRecruiter.com/Marty. That's ZipRecruiter.com/MARTY. ZipRecruiter.com/Marty. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Very few minds are smarter about the history of sport than Brent Musburger's. Why? Because Brent lived it. And man, it was so cool to spend 30, 35 minutes with him. Here is my conversation on the Marty Smith's America podcast with legendary sports broadcaster Brent Musburger. Man, it's such a pleasure to welcome to the Marty Smith's America podcast a legend among legends in the sports broadcasting realm, Brent Musburger, who, if it's been a huge moment in sports in the last 35 or 40 years even, man, he was either there or he called it. And so it's just amazing to spend this time with you, sir. And I always like to discuss what people helped you and were influential in your journey. And you've had such an amazing journey. Who were a couple of those people that were real spearheads that believed in you and enabled you to have that career?
You know, Marty, luck and timing played an incredible role in my journey. When I was a newspaper man in Chicago, the CBS radio station transferred from all talk over to news and information. And the sportscaster at the time, a fellow by the name of Rick Weaver, was very uncomfortable doing the two-minute news updates. And he wanted badly to return to play-by-play and talk radio. So he caught on as the voice of the Miami Dolphins when the NFL expanded down to Miami. And the radio station, a general manager by the name of Bill O'Donnell, had heard me simply as a guest a few times. And so he called me over. I was a columnist at the time at the Chicago's American. And he offered me a job which paid me considerably more than I was making at the newspaper. And I had a family started at the time, and I wanted to buy a house in suburban Chicago. So I told him, yes, I think I can do that, but I owe the newspaper at least a visit. And I went over to the managing editor, and he couldn't believe that I was willing to give up a newspaper column to return and become a radio broadcaster full time. And when he didn't offer me a dime more, I said, look, it's been great. I've enjoyed it. Thank you very much, but I'm going to radio. So I made the transition over to radio. And about the same time, the news blocks on the stations, the local stations, started to expand because there was no ESPN, there was no cable, there was no place to go for sports information, especially locally. So the TV station was located in the same building as the radio, and they asked me, would you cut a commentary for us? We'd like to see, and we'd like to think about using you as a commentator. And so I... being a newspaper man, I knew that a little controversy won't hurt here. So I taped about a minute and a half, as I recall, a commentary suggesting that the Chicago Blackhawks needed to trade either Bobby Hull or Stan Mikita. And they ran that on a Sunday evening, and it broke the all-time negative phone list down below at the television station. So the first part of the week, the general manager called. He wanted me full-time because of the response he got out of it. And I said, listen, I'm not going to suggest that the Cubs trade either Ernie Banks or Ron Santo or go from there. So be mindful that was a one-time only. And Bobby Hull and Stan Mikita and I laughed about it for years to come. They went on to win a Stanley Cup together. And obviously the Blackhawks didn't trade either one, even though Bobby later wound up playing for the Winnipeg Jets in the rival hockey league that started up. But when I was with the television station full-time, general manager by the name of Bob Wessler was moved by CBS to New York to head up the sports division. And that's when Bob decided that we needed a live pregame show, which led to the NFL today. So all of those stops along the line. But Marty, a lot of young people ask me, you know, how do I become a sportscaster? What do I do? And it's very hard for me because I was in the right place at the right time. And I don't attribute any great intellect. I just think that I was very, very fortunate when I got the opportunities along the way. I knew that I had this opportunity, and I made the most of it during the time. So it's very difficult. When I started out, there were not a lot of sportscasters. Like I said earlier, there was no ESPN. There were none of the cable outlets. And so you really relied on the local television stations. But it's been a wonderful journey. As it began, I fell under the influence of people like Harry Carey. Not always good, because Harry and I would drink the night away sometimes, but he was one of the great characters that I was around. Vin Scully, I was fortunate enough to work with him. Dick Enberg along the way, all these guys that I knew. And it was a great era to be a sportscaster growing up. And that's just a long way of saying a whole lot of people entered into this. And I was very fortuitous, and I loved every minute of it.
I can relate. I'm a very similar story. I'm a newspaper man as well. I studied print journalism in college. I was a newspaper writer out of college, and then this new thing happened called the internet, and I became a writer on an internet site, and on and on, and then out of nowhere, ESPN called one day. People believed in me and believed in my passion and my approach, and I have been so blessed by that. So I can relate to what you're saying. Now, I want to go back to Harry Carey just a minute. What the hell is it like drinking beers with Harry Carey? That must be the greatest time a man can have.
You got that right, Marty. In the first place, you never had to pay for it. Okay, Harry was extremely, extremely generous. And he loved medium. At that time, because I was doing the 10 o'clock strip with Central Time Zone, and so the news block would come up at 10 o'clock in New York, of course, East Coast. The local news comes on at 11, but it was 10 o'clock in Chicago, and the Cubs didn't have lights at the time, so his games were always over. And so he would meet me at a place called Tommy O'Leary's that I would walk down to, and he would drop by, and he was already holding court. Harry Carey's restaurant had not yet started up, so he used O'Leary's basically as a base. And it was wonderful to watch. I learned a great lesson from Harry, and that is when a person comes up to you in a setting like that, you sign their autograph, you talk to him. He would stand there at the bar and sign every napkin and every cup program. People knew where he was hanging out, and then they would leave him alone. And other announcers who were in town would always drop by. And we shared anecdotes, and I just loved sitting there and listening to Harry Carey. I will never forget the evening. Somehow we got on the morbid topic of passing away. Harry said to the group, "Now listen. Don't any of you, ever allow them to cremate me, because I'll burn for 50 years." And of course, we laughed and laughed and hoisted another round. So it was awesome to be around Harry. He actually tried to hire me to come in to be his relief announcer with the Cubs at WGN to work middle two or three innings. I honestly hesitated before I said no. It gave me a few nights, sleepless nights. One of the great characters of all time. And in that particular era, baseball announcers were at the top of the sports announcing food chain. That's no longer the situation. Television, especially football, has replaced baseball as the number one go-to sport for majority of the American population. But back in that day when I started out, baseball was number one, and Harry Carey was clearly the king in Chicago.
Why'd you say no?
You know, I'm not quite sure. I think I loved CBS. I mean, there was nothing negative about CBS at the time. The NFL Today had started up. Irv and Phyllis and Jimmy the Greek were great friends of mine. So I just thought, no, let me stick with what I'm doing. They've given me this great opportunity. And I did. I had long meetings with there were a couple of times when I almost left CBS. The other one was Ron Arledge came and wanted to hire me once for the Howard Cosell role on Monday Night Football. And that, again, led some sleepless nights on my part. I came very close. Rune probably would have said yes to the ABC offer, knowing how controversial I was about to become if I stepped into that, because I knew what Rune wanted. We talked about it for a long, long time. Frank Gifford was the play-by-play man, and they wanted a little more vinegar to go in there with the all-time good guy, Frank, and then they would have had an athlete. I don't remember who it was at the time. Who would have been? It would have been back to a three-man booth. And Arun flew off to an affiliate meeting in Hawaii when I called back, and I was all prepared to tell him yes, and then I couldn't reach him. He was in an airplane. And by the time he arrived over in Honolulu for that meeting, I'd had a change of heart and decided to stay at CBS. At no time in either of those did I go back and ask for more money or try to negotiate. They were both great offers, and I gave them both serious, serious consideration.
Wow. Isn't that amazing? I mean, if his plane lands earlier, your path might have been completely different. Fascinating.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You've noted the NFL today a couple of times, and as a little guy, a little tyke, I can remember watching it with my daddy every Sunday. And it's this titan. It's this institution that is, in terms of sports broadcasting, it was the example by which all that became the NFL pregame shows was founded. So it had to have changed your life dramatically. How did it change your life?
Oh, absolutely. Well, first of all, it made me completely. I mean, first of all, you came in with a last name, Musburger. I didn't change it. Back in my day, a lot of announcers on television actually changed their last name. For example, Jim McKay was actually Jimmy McManus, and he had already changed his last name. So there was this unusual last name, a longer last name than broadcast personalities used, and it became known strictly through the NFL Today. I was simply an unknown commodity out of the city of Chicago. And so the NFL Today is responsible for every bit of my career once I moved to the network level in New York. I mean, that's the show that gave me a presence, and then people knew who I was because of the NFL Today. And it was, as you say, it set the standard because we were first. And it was Bob Wessler's idea to go live and have live halftime and post-game shows at the time. Because in that particular time, Pete Rozelle, the commissioner who I was already very, very friendly with, because he'd been a PR man with the Los Angeles Rams and everything back in the day before he became commissioner. Back in that day, the NFL made sure that the networks were extremely profitable regarding their coverage on Sunday, especially CBS. That's how Rozelle cut the contract with the networks. After the prices soared for the individual franchises in the NFL, that changed completely. The team owners wanted to milk every dollar they could out of television simply because of their costs. So the networks had to move in a different direction to get back what they were paying for this great programming, and so they expanded. The NFL Today was a half hour every Sunday, as you know, and now I think, goodness, they run upwards of 2 hours because they need that commercial revenue to pay for what they're paying the National Football League. ESPN obviously doesn't have Sunday games, but they have an extensive pregame show because they need that revenue to pay the league what they owe for their rights to Monday Night Football. So it became more of a money game after that. I've always thought that we had an advantage only going 30 minutes. It led to problems with Jimmy the Greek and Phyllis because both wanted airtime during the 30 minutes. But you could be, I think, more succinct. You could offer stories that people were interested in rather than just sort of droning on and on, which is sometimes the case because you don't have that much to go on with the games having not started yet on a Sunday when you run the long, long pregame shows. But it's strictly related to money and nothing else. What changed? But during the days of the NFL Today, it was the growth spurt for the National Football League. That's where they took over clearly as number one. When it came to the hearts and minds of the American sports fans, it was great being a part of it and having the show go live. And I loved every minute of the NFL Today. When CBS fired me in 1990, that particular fall, I'll never forget the first Sunday I was out at the ranch in Montana, and I couldn't even turn on the television set. I just walked kind of around out in the fields and went out and made friends with a couple of horses out there and talked to them. It was such a withdrawal for me because I missed the action on that first Sunday. Probably, I'm not an unhappy person. I'm an optimistic person. That was probably the toughest day of my broadcast life, was not being on the air in that fall of 1990 on that opening Sunday of the National Football League, because I loved every the controversy that erupted with Jimmy the Greek and things like that. I loved every minute of the NFL Today. It was great. And whatever I was able to accomplish in broadcast, it's a result of the NFL Today. I don't think there's any question about that.
You noted that your surname suddenly becomes one of the most recognizable in entertainment. And so you got famous. I mean, there wasn't Twitter. There wasn't the internet. There weren't all of these countless myriad outlets to consume sports, news, or entertainment. There was you guys. So you guys became really famous. How'd you manage fame?
You know, Marty, it's kind of interesting. I never let it affect me one way or the other. I think sometimes we'd go out to dinner, and I think my wife was bothered more than me. People would come up and intrude at the table. And so I guess the most valuable lesson that I took from those days with Harry Carey is that when you're out in a public situation, you belong to the public, because that's who made you what you are. They're responsible for whatever riches and fame that you have, and so that you owe to be nice back to the public. And if you want to escape that, you simply go home and read a book or talk to the family and avoid it. I always had that. I knew when I could be real, real private. It's just go home to Arlene, and I was very fortunate. You know, we've been married now, I guess, 57 years. I had the two boys and always had nice homes to retreat to and always enjoyed. So I knew how to find my privacy. But when I would go out publicly, a restaurant or wherever, airports, whatever, anybody wanted to come up and talk, I knew that everybody had their own team, and they had their own agenda about sports. It's a point of view. And I was always kind of interested in what people had to say, because I knew that they also knew more about their team than I did. I didn't know as much about all the teams as they did about their individual team. I knew a little bit about every team, but I always kind of kept my ears open as I traveled through this, and I learned a lot. I learned a lot from the folks out there, but I never, you know, it wasn't why I got into the business to become famous. I love sports. I was not a good enough athlete. I would have preferred to have played. I would have preferred to have been a Major League Baseball player, but I was never going to be that good in any particular sport. But I always knew, even when I was 6 years old, I always knew that I wanted to be around it, because I enjoyed the rhythm of it. I enjoyed the competition. Even now, I love to, in my spare time, as I have done the last couple of weeks, I love the National Hockey League playoffs and the NBA playoffs, and I watch every night and marvel at the athletic ability that's out there. And you know, the Indianapolis 500 is coming up. I've been interested in how they're pushing, and I'll be watching the race on Sunday and seeing how they do. So if it's competition, I just enjoy it. That's the rhythm of my life.
Who was your favorite athlete to cover, whom you got to know personally?
Well, it became characters after a while. Probably the most important to me was probably Muhammad Ali, simply because when the radio station first hired me, the one thing that I had done for them as a newspaper man, I had gone down and gotten one of those interviews with Muhammad Ali. Now, an interview with Muhammad Ali back in the day was basically ask a question and get out of the way. He would take it from there. He was the ultimate showman. I would go down to his house on the south side of Chicago. He had converted. He had become a Muslim at the time. And you would go into his house. I knew the bodyguards would be in there. I knew they would be standing at the end of the hall with their suit jackets covering up. They were both packing every day. But then they would let you go in because Muhammad knew you from being on the air in Chicago, and he loved to entertain. So he was certainly He was an important cog in my success because of the interviews that I would get from just showing up at the tape recorder and later with a camera down. Probably the fellow that I really got to enjoy in Chicago was Ernie Banks, because he too was such an easy interview. And I loved his optimism. I loved his smile. The people in Chicago loved him. The manager of the Chicago White Sox at the time was Al Lopez, and he was such a gentleman. And when I traveled with them, he taught me basically all about baseball. He'd been a Hall of Fame catcher in his playing day before he became manager of the Cleveland Indians and later the Chicago White Sox. Those people were important to me because of their availability whenever I needed an interview. But there were so many. And then later I developed a very close relationship with Pete Rose in sort of an unusual way, because he had come in as a player. He was an expert during the World Series on the NFL Today. And the next week, Jimmy the Greek was taken ill. And we all knew that Pete liked to take a position on football, wager on games. And we brought him in to handicap games. And even now, here in Las Vegas, when I run into Pete after one of his autograph sessions, he'll remind me that he was a better handicapper than Jimmy the Greek. So it goes on and on. In my day, the one difference is that we were much closer to the athletes than the media folks are today. After a baseball game, for example, I might go out drinking with a young Dave DeBuscher, who was then a rookie pitcher with the Chicago White Sox, but we would no more think about writing about DeBuscher having maybe one too many beers and then getting back to the hotel room because he wasn't due to start pitching for another couple of days. Those things, we were friends with the athletes back in the day. Yes, sometimes we'd have to criticize them, but Dick Young of the New York Daily News taught me that when you criticize an athlete, the one thing that you must do is show up the next day. You walk in there and you give him a chance to disagree with you. And I learned that lesson. And whenever I criticized an athlete, I was always there. You want to talk to me? Come on. And we had a much better relationship than the media does today. You know, if an athlete went into a bar in my time, there was no cell phone taking a picture of him. Nobody was going to send that out over Twitter. It's the lack of privacy for an athlete today, I'm sure, has made it very, very tough on some of these fellows. So it was an entirely different time.
What impact does the loosening of sports gambling and it becoming more accepted have on Pete Rose's opportunity to be a Hall of Famer, Brent?
You know, Marty, it's a very good question. I've given it a lot of thought. The problem with me is that I've thought all along, a problem in my point of view, is that I have felt all along that he belongs in the Hall of Fame, and I have said at the bottom of the plaque, it should say that he was suspended in whatever year for gambling on baseball. I don't think we should ignore history. I think it's a vital part of the narrative about the game and certainly about Pete Rose. It obviously down the road has to help him. In some regard, there is going to be some power broker who's going to not agree with me, but he's going to come to the same conclusion that this guy belongs in the Hall of Fame, but we should not ignore what happened to him in the end. And so I think it will come to pass. Do I think it is close? No, I don't think it is close at all, but I think it will happen someday. There's another fellow who certainly belongs in the Hall of Fame also, in my mind, and that's Barry Bonds. I was around Barry's father, Bobby Bonds, quite a bit, and Bobby wound up having problems with alcohol. And so then he had to go to rehab, took the cure, came back, and was clean, and was able to go on with his career. And his son, before he got into whatever anabolic steroids he was involved with, was a tremendous athlete for the Pittsburgh Pirates. Everybody remembers Barry with the San Francisco 49ers, as well they should, because that's where the home run prowess came to the forefront. But it's hard to ignore Now, whether or not you have an entire wing in the Hall of Fame or you include people tend to forget that what Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa did that one year helped bring baseball back, and both
Save
of them
baseball.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yes, bring baseball back with that great home run chase that they had. So all of those are controversies that we'll let the baseball people sort out. But beyond a shadow of a doubt, Pete Rose belongs in the Hall of Fame.
Let's stay on that topic because it's what you do now out in Vegas, of course. You do such a great job out there with the program you guys do, focusing on betting and making sure people are making the right bets and taking care of their paper. What do you think is the greater, broader stroke impact, Brent, of people accepting sports gambling more readily today?
You know, it's hard to put your arms around one reason, Marty. First of all, I think there has to be a concern and care. I have said all along, even though I'm in favor of legalizing it, because when it was illegal, people were doing it anyway. And so I believe that it should be carefully watched. But not everybody should jump into it. And I hope that youngsters don't think it's easy, because it's not. In a game like football, for example, as the Greek always told me, the football is not round, so you're going to get those crazy bounces, things like that. Obviously, gambling in particular had a huge part in the rise of the National Football League. Now, point spreads, that was a stroke of genius by the bookmakers who came up with that, because if you were just picking winners, it gets pretty one-sided. But when you add the element of the point spread, it's like adding the element of weights to a jockey in a horse race. It's a lot. It's something that I've always been interested in. It fascinates me. I know how difficult it is to win on a regular basis. It fuels interest in the games. I think right now the media has jumped on it because it was a forbidden fruit and suddenly it's legal. And I think down the road it'll become more like Europe. It's there, but you don't pay that much attention to it, to be perfectly honest. When you go over last year, for example, I was in London with the Raiders for a football game. So I made it a point to go into the various bet shops. Having been in London as often as I was, I knew that they exist on basically every street corner. You've got two or three of the competing bet shops. And they're kind of quiet. They're certainly not as elaborate as our sports books are in the United States. And, you know, people are not thinking about the Premier League in terms of gambling 24/7. And I think it'll settle into that rhythm in the United States. It'll just become part of it. If you want to take a position on the Toronto Raptors and the Milwaukee Bucks when they go back up to Toronto, and the Raptors are looking to close it out, and they will be a slight favorite in that game. If you want the money line or you want to give the points, go ahead. But you can sit there and enjoy that game without having a wager on it too. I mean, that's we will see what kind of a rhythm it settles into. Over in Europe, people in particular, I'm going to use golf, they like to bet during a tournament as it's unfolding. They'll see a particular player that they want to bet on or they want to bet against somebody. In the United States, people are opinionated before the game. This team is going to win. So I'm not quite sure that in-game wagering is going to go to the extent that it has over in Europe. I think there's a lot of time during a soccer match in the Premier League when you can make a different wager. When you're watching, in particular, a basketball game, it's very hard to bet in-game because things move so quickly and fast. Now, during that period, the bookmakers don't have as much time either. So somebody who is sharp about numbers and has an idea can move quickly and make a bet. But I'd like to repeat, it's not for everybody. Not every youngster should think that he can retire and become a sports bettor. And I don't think you have to bet to enjoy a game either, by the way. But I do think that because it exists and because so much money has been involved, that we need to have it legalized and we need to watch over it. The problem with the politicians is they want the tax revenue. And if you look at the books out of Nevada, it doesn't generate nearly as much revenue for the state as, say, slot machines do. That's the profit center in the state of Nevada. If a book makes 4 or 5% in a given month, that's a very, very good month. And I think the politicians have an idea that you make 20% and 30% off these sports bets, and you do not. So I think it's going to become part of the American culture. I think it'll settle down. Right now, everybody's making a big deal out of it. I know that your boss is the ESPN building a studio. I think Bleacher Report is putting one up. And, of course, the heart of it in the United States will always remain to be Las Vegas, where more of the more prominent bookmakers are. And it's when you lead up to a Super Bowl, I always thought that one of the things the public wants to know, who's favored and by how many points. But that doesn't mean that everybody's going to bet that. They're just interested in it as a point of reference. And that's what I always thought was a huge part of the sports gambling business.
Couple more things, my man, and I'll get you out of here. You were talking about horse racing and jockeys a moment ago, and I have never experienced anything in my career like standing on the racetrack at Churchill Downs a couple weeks ago when that seven came off the tote board, and everything shifted when the stewards disqualified Maximum Security from the Kentucky Derby. I can't imagine what it must have been like in Vegas. What was the financial impact of that decision in Las Vegas, Nevada?
Marty, it was crazy. I thought when Maximum Security first came down, everybody was kind of stunned, to tell you the truth. Normally, like if you have a March Madness and there's a buzzer beater, somebody knocks down a winning basket, the room explodes. That didn't happen with this. There was kind of a quiet. The horse player, the daily horse player in Las Vegas, the majority never expected him to come down. Okay. But they felt that was because it was a Kentucky Derby that they would leave him up. And that seemed to be the opinion. I mean, it went on for more than 20 minutes. That seemed to be the opinion in the room. There was not a lot of shouting and yelling. They were just waiting for it to become official. Of course, there were a lot more bettors who had Maximum Security in the particular race. I've seen all the different angles, as you have since then. And I find myself agreeing now with the stewards. However, I wish that they had a rule that they use in English horse racing. I would not have dropped him all the way down to whatever wound up being 16th, 17th place after one of the horses that he interfered with had faded way back. I would have placed him no worse than third in that particular race, which they can do in England. I don't think under any circumstances he would have faded out of the money. Yes, it was a dangerous situation. Warren Will, I believe it was, who first impacted him as he came out. And on the one angle, he did move out two or three lanes. But in Vegas, it was more shock that Maximum Security came down than anything else.
Us too. Standing there real time on the track, waiting and waiting and waiting. And then when that seven came off the board, there was a noticeable audible gasp that washed across the 160,000 people there. And I was looking at my producer and she was looking at me and we were like, what in the hell just happened? And then the booze started to rain down along with the rain and the mud. And it was just it was chaos at that point. It was unlike anything I've ever covered. Speaking of great, amazing moments that we've covered, I would love to know, and I'll let you go after this. This is going to be a hard one for you, Brent. What is the greatest game you ever called?
You know, Marty, I can't decide. I've been around too many games. You know, there's a song It includes a line. It's a country and western song, which I love to listen to out here in Montana, that yesterday is dead and gone. So what I'm hopeful of is that when the Oakland Raiders play the Denver Broncos on that first Monday night game on ESPN, and I'm in the radio booth for the Raiders, that becomes the greatest NFL game that I've ever covered. Because I always concern myself the most about tomorrow, because that's the only thing I can control. And I've been around so many great games in the past. The two that I think that have appeared on television the most, so I'll give you the two that I get asked about the most. One, the famous Hail Flutie, Doug Flutie in Boston College rallying against Miami in college football. And the other was a triple overtime in the NBA on a Friday night in Boston between the Phoenix Suns and the Boston Celtics, game five of the finals, won by the Celtics in the three overtimes. I get asked about that because they get replayed the most. So I guess I would go back to those two simply because I get asked the most questions. I'll give you a close with an anecdote about Flutie, because as a result of that, of course, we became great friends because we've done so many shows together about the end of that football game. But as it unfolded in following the penalty and Doug pulled out to throw the final Hail Mary pass into the end zone, which was caught, I couldn't tell who'd caught the football. But I was fortunate enough to have a graduate of Boston College in the truck. His name was Kevin O'Malley. He was an executive at CBS. He knew a lot about broadcasting, and he reached over the producer's shoulder. He pulled the talkback key back and said, "Brent, it's Phelan, Gerard Phelan." To which, if you listen to that, I don't believe it going on. And then maybe after a little time lapse, I throw in the name. So Doug and I are doing an anniversary special on the play, and I tell him the anecdote that I just told you, and he says to me, "Brent, I got to tell you the truth. I didn't know who caught it." I said, "Come on, Doug." He said, "No." He said, after we collapse on the field and everybody's hugging, and we run off the orange ball up into the tunnel, I've got the center right next to me, and I said, Who caught the ball?" And he goes, "Doug, it was your roommate, Phelan." So it just some of those little things that happen during the great moments in sports.
Well, you absolutely are one of those soundtracks of my youth growing up and into my professional career. And I will tell you this, I will leave you with this. One of the great moments of my professional life was 2007. I'm greener than grass. I've never made television before in my life. And I'm at Daytona. I'm in Daytona Beach, Florida. And I get on the elevator in the hotel in Daytona Beach, Florida. And I'm scared as hell. And I don't know what I'm doing. And into the elevator walks Brent Musburger. And I am on this elevator with this icon. And I don't know what to say. Do you say hello? Do you just shut up? Do you show reverence? Do you tell him you appreciate him? What do you do? So I just kind of nodded my head and said, "Hello, sir. My name's Marty Smith. I'm one of these reporters over here for ESPN." And whether it was true or not, man, you go, "Oh yeah, Marty, I know your work. I appreciate your work. I've read a lot of what you've done." And the door opens and I'm in shock, and you exit the elevator. And the first thing I did, this was about a year before my daddy died. The first thing I did was I got off that elevator and I called my daddy and I said, "Man, you're not going to believe this. Brent Musburger might have been lying to me, but I think he might know who I am." And my daddy thought that was the coolest thing of all time, and I still do. So thank you, bro.
I know who you are. Trust me, Marty. I know who you were, lad. I still follow you guys at ESPN. You know what I mean?
Yep, I know, and I appreciate it so much, and I know you're busy. I know you got a big day coming up here, so thank you so much. God bless you, and we appreciate your time and insight, sir. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Marty, my man. We'll talk to you down the road. You take care now.
Yes, sir.
Keep up the good work.
Man, what a storyteller. I love it. Thanks so much to Brent for giving me so much of his time. And thanks to ZipRecruiter. The reason you guys got to hear that is because of ZipRecruiter. That interview was brought to you guys by ZipRecruiter.com. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. I love what he just said there to close the interview about Doug Flutie, Travis, because you talk about iconic moments in college football history. Something you and me are as passionate about as anybody on this planet is iconic college football moments. And he called the Doug Flutie Hail Mary in the Orange Bowl against the Miami Hurricanes.
See, I knew
he
that one.
He called it.
I knew that was going to be what he picked because it's so iconic and it just never gets old to hear. I was hoping that he'd pick a couple other games that I was slightly a little biased to because he's, you know, for me, he's the voice that I always hear because he's always calling Ohio State games, and two stick out for me. One, Ohio State versus Purdue, holy Buckeye. And then when Ohio State beat the team up north that same year, his words were, let's party Columbus, when they punched their ticket to go to the national championship game.
Those two. What year was that, 02?
Those were 02. I remember where I was for both of those games.
I mean, it's crazy. What I think about is, of course, you weren't born yet. I think about being 8, 9 years old and that just nasty Celtics-Lakers rivalry in the NBA Finals that seemed to be staged annually in the Boston Garden and the Great Western Forum. And Brent Musburger called those things. Along with Pat O'Brien was the sideline guy. And I just remember his presence, man. He commanded. Those moments seemed so massive. As a little boy in the middle of nowhere, Virginia, with three channels on the television, and me and Daddy locked in on those games, just on, with bated breath, every single thing that was about to happen. You know, I can even, it's, those games from my youth were so indelible. I mean, I can name you, what you got? Magic, Kareem, Kurt Rambis, Byron Scott, Michael Cooper, Michael Thompson, Clay's dad. All those guys are in my mind. And that's the Lakers side. You know, you got Bird, Parrish, Dennis Johnson, Kevin McHale, Chief, Bill Walton. Like, I can remember it so well, so vividly, because it was so intense. And Brent was right in the middle of those things, calling those games. And it's just so cool to hear his perspective. And as I said to him there during the interview, it just blew my mind. I had to call my dad and tell him that, man, I talked to Brent Musburger, and Daddy, I think that man might know who I am. Maybe. Wow. I've been very blessed with those kinds of moments, and that one was special to me, and I appreciate his time.
So I think I failed you, and we forgot one question to ask him, which now we'll just have to have him back on, is how did he come up with the "you're looking live"? Because that's his
saying.
Well,
that's on my list. It's on my list. I thought about it, but I wanted to get him out of there as quick as I could after asking him all that other stuff.
Because that's one of those ones where you know that that's his saying. Everybody hopes to have something like that. Like, he's got one, and it's
everyone, he has like three or four of them, man. And "you are looking live" is certainly the most recognizable. So thanks to Brent. I learned a lot. He might be like, I mean, what, we got four or five straight guests now that we got to have a second installment. So we'll add him to that list, and we'll ask him about "you're looking live." Now it's time to discuss something about which Travis and I are, if not experts, then we are at least well-practiced. That's chugging beer. And this is brought to you by Tissot. Tissot is the official watch of the NBA. Each one of Tissot's timepieces delivers quality performance and traditional luxury. This is graduation season, guys. So this graduation season, make sure to get the NBA fan in your life a Tissot watch. The Tissot Chrono XL is a great watch for those looking for a sporty chronograph with Swiss technology at an unbeatable price. Shop now at us.tissotshop.com. I have been 43 years old for a month now. 6 weeks. Travis still hadn't got me a watch.
I'll get you for your next birthday, maybe.
I just don't know what's going on, man. They are obviously invested in us. So all you got to do is make a, it's like your Tito's liquor. It's like your vodka. Call the CEO of Tiso and tell him we want to interview him. Then we'll get some watches.
But if not, we'll settle for a couple watches.
Yeah. You can say no. That's cool. Just send us a Tiso Chrono XL. It's two of them. That's all we're asking for. We do appreciate, in all seriousness, Tiso's belief in us and support of us, because look, they support us so that we can keep this thing free for you guys, so that you guys can listen and not have to pay to listen. So thank you so much to Tiso and to ZipRecruiter. Now, let's get to chugging beer.
What are we going to do, bud?
We're going to drink one of these beers.
Hand me one of them damn beers real quick.
What's up, man? Party party.
So one thing that I've really enjoyed about the NBA Finals is the fact that when they're playing in Milwaukee, there's a chugging beer contest on the Jumbotron. And it has made the, what's that offensive lineman's name, Travis?
David Battiari.
All right. It's made him famous. I mean, it's made him famous. He's everywhere, all over social media, Instagram, Twitter, chugging these beers. And I will tell you, my man can chug a beer. I mean, it's gone. Right down the pipe, man. Right down. Gone. See ya. So at game 5 in Milwaukee of the Eastern Conference Finals, this started happening again on the Jumbotron. And so the lineman, say his name again, Travis.
David Battiari. That could be wrong,
very
too.
Very good. David. So David is sitting right beside Christian Yelich, right? And so David pounds down this beer, and he looks over at Yelich, and Yelich chokes down his beer. And then they look across the court at Aaron Rodgers. So Rodgers, it's his turn to chug his beer, and Rodgers is not impressed with Yelich. He says, no, he only had a half a cup. I'm not impressed by that. So then Rodgers, he chugs his beer. Well, I don't think that Matthew Stafford, the Detroit Lions quarterback, was very impressed with that. So they're at a restaurant, him and his wife and some buddies or whatever. They put it on social media of Matthew pounding down this cold beer. So that then led Travis and me to this debate that we've had for the last few days about what NFL quarterback would be the champion of cold beer chugging. And I have two on my list that I think will be in the finals. I think it could be Baker Mayfield versus Josh Allen. Cleveland Browns against the Buffalo Bills.
Baker's a good one to go with.
I mean, look, Baker's 110% on everything Baker does. And so I bet Baker could do it. I bet he'd be really good at it. But Josh, I mean, Josh is a big old boy. I bet he could erase a beer real quick, too.
I think I'm going to go with Josh on this one. I just feel like a little bigger guy, being up in Buffalo now with the Bills Mafia, I feel like that's kind of like a prerequisite.
That's what they do.
I assume that at his combine or his special workout with the Bills, that they're like, all right, listen, we don't care about your 40. Like, what's your chug time? Because our fans can't have some dude just sipping on some Pinot. We need a guy that's going to go out there and chug some beers.
So that is our homework for you guys this week. Hopefully, some of you guys watched The Last Waltz, your homework from last week. This week, we want you guys to send us a note on the Twitter machine, at Marty Smith ESPN, at Travis Rockhold. Send us a note of why your quarterback, whoever your favorite team is, why your quarterback should be in contention, should be considered as the greatest beer chugger among NFL signal callers.
Did you see Aaron Rodgers' tweet afterwards?
I did not.
So he sent it to David Bakhtiari, and he said, make it scotch next time.
Ooh,
so he's kind of making some excuses, also trying to say, hey, I'm a classy drinker here. I need, you know, scotch.
Well, listen, Aaron lives in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Green Bay, Wisconsin. They don't drink scotch.
His diet should consume.
That's a beer town.
Beer and cheese curds.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I think he should, what he should do is look, the guy is, in my opinion, I think he's the best player in football. He blows my mind, man. The throws he makes, the comebacks, you know, he's Captain Comeback. And so, he is really, really good at football. He needs to up his game with a cold beer in his hand.
I feel like Philip Rivers might be a sneaky, yeah, just man, beer guy.
He's a sneaky old country boy. I bet he could pound one, too.
Like, he wears a bolo. You can't wear a bolo without being able to chug beer.
Does he wear a bolo?
He always wears a bolo. He loves his bolos.
No, that's awesome.
Yeah, loves his bolos.
Richard Petty wears a bolo. Should I start incorporating a bolo into my repertoire?
I don't know. It maybe depends on what the event you're at.
I mean, bolos are pretty cool. I think I wore one in eighth grade basketball once. Mr. McGraw, Coach McGraw, used to make us in eighth grade basketball. We had to wear our nicest clothes to school on game days. And we grew up in Parrishburg, man. It's a bunch of country kids. We didn't have the nicest clothes. And I remember one day I laid out my clothes before I went to school, and I had like some navy pants, like, you know, navy pleated khaki pants or whatever. I had a purple shirt, lavender shirt. I had some kind of paisley tie that was purple and green and blue, and I thought it tied everything together. I was wrong. So I put away the tie, and I went with the bolo.
So, wait, did you have one, or was it like your dad's tie?
No, it was mine.
You had a bolo tie at that age?
I think all of us. I feel like it was a thing for the Giles Spartan 8th grade basketball team back in 1989.
Was this at the same time of your cornucopia bad decisions?
Yeah, it was the same era.
So you're, yeah, so you're back in the cornucopia of bad decisions plus a bolo?
Yeah, man.
I assume you didn't have a girlfriend.
That's pretty solid. Dude, I had all kinds of girlfriends. What are you talking about, man? Let's see. Let me think about it. My girlfriend, I didn't have a girlfriend in 8th grade. No, I did not. I had no girlfriend in 8th grade.
I wonder what the reason was.
In 7th grade, I'm pretty sure 7th grade. 7th grade, my little girlfriend was Sherry Ratcliffe. And she was a cheerleader on the Parrisburg Lions, and I was I played for the Parrisburg Lions Pop Warner football team. And I don't remember if Sherry let me hold her hand or not, but with the cornucopia of bad decisions, probably not.
I can't imagine the cornucopia plus the bolo was really attracting too many of them. But maybe,
man,
that was a thing back then.
What are you talking about? Man, the cornucopia of bad decisions coupled with the lavender shirt and the navy pants, and probably I had on some old, like, cons. I had probably, you know what? I put up a thing the other day. I put up a tweet the other day. I don't know what made me think of it, but I just got to thinking about my shoes when I was a kid. And I had the Walter Payton Kangaroos. I had the Walter Payton Kangaroos that were navy, orange, and white. They were the sweetness roos, and they had a tongue pocket where you could put your milk money. And I probably had those on along with my navy pants and my lavender shirt and my turquoise bolo tie. Now this thing was sweet, man. It had like a turquoise gem thing in the middle and some silver on it.
Is this back when
looked
you were
like
in the Dickies
Ronnie
too?
Dunn should be wearing to the Ronnie Dunn should be wearing that thing out to the show.
Is this back when you were in Dickies too?
Oh, for sure. Oh yeah, man. Oh yeah.
Yeah, we
and for whatever reason, when we were throwing hay, we decided it was a good idea not to wear shirts. I am, you know what I call being a ginger, right? I call it gingivitis. I mean, here I am, I got this gingivitis, and you just burn to a crisp, and then you turn white again. It just doesn't make any, like, I don't know what I was trying to prove, man.
I don't even know what to say.
Yeah, I'm glad. I left you speechless. All right, that means we should be done. That amazing bit of idiocy was Story Time with Marty and Travis, brought to you by Tissot. Tissot, the official watch of the NBA. Shop at us.tissotshop.com.
And before you close it out for us, Marty, I've been getting some good requests on iTunes, but people keep sending reviews, and in that review, you can put who you want me to go after. There's already a couple people that I've noticed on the reviews and I'm going after, so continue to subscribe, rate, and review, and leave names of who we should have on this podcast.
Yeah, man. Let us know who you guys want us to chat with, because we're really enjoying it. I just learned so much, and I love the podcast forum because it allows a conversation to breathe, and you get a lot of cool insight that way. All right. That's the Marty Smith's America Podcast, Volume 55. It was awesome to have my man Brent Musburger on. Appreciate Travis getting him on. Thanks so much to Louise for being crazy enough to let us try this mess. As always, man, I'm so appreciative of Dan, Stu, Mike, everybody that's involved in the Lebatard and Friends Podcast Network. They have made this so fulfilling for us, and so many of you guys are consuming it as a result of them believing in us. So thanks so much to those guys. Appreciate you guys for listening. Thank you. Ain't no reason to do it if you guys aren't listening. Please, as Travis said, subscribe, rate, and review. Let us know who you'd like for us to chase for an interview, who you'd like to hear from. And especially on Memorial Day. Today is Memorial Day. When this podcast is posted, it's going to be Memorial Day. I am so appreciative of our military members all over this world who preserve our freedom. And on this Memorial Day, I'm especially appreciative of all who have served and died to preserve our freedom. We are the greatest country in the world. And the members of our military who sacrificed and gave their lives so that we could be free will never be forgotten. Thank you to every one of them and their families today. We're thinking of all of you guys, and we're remembering all of our heroes in uniform. Thank you so much. We appreciate it. We'll try to do better next time. Y'all be good. This is the Marty Smith's America Podcast, Volume 55. We'll see you next time around.